I'm Karen, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. How many of you want one more day cooking, shopping, cleaning, kids, decorations? Come on.
I will.
Oh, God. Hey, 666. Do you go to Al-Anon?
You need a baby.
Well, we had a good time. But boy, I'm kind of glad it's over. And Happy New Year's, everybody.
Happy New Year.
We're not drunk. There's no little kids running from us tonight. No, we're not out with the wrong woman or the wrong man. It's pretty miraculous. I was telling friends on the way over here that my kids have got pictures of me in feathered earrings and crop tops and clog heels. And you know, I look at those pictures and I thought I was having a good time. And they're embarrassing, and yet they're also, you know, I was a 60s kid, 60s and 70s. And I didn't really want to grow up. I had no intention of growing up. But alcoholism got a hold of me and made me grow up. That's just kind of the way that happened. You know, I remember when you started this group. And it's an honor to be here. Out of North Central Texas. And a few drunks and a coffee pot. And you got a group, and I've been here when there were three or four or five or six or two. And how many locations now, guys? Well, that's okay. There's nothing, I mean nothing mal about that. It's just that's the wonder of recovery, is that people get together and help one another. And there's a message in that. And that's, you're always here for me, and I'm always here for you. It doesn't matter where you are. It doesn't matter how you got here. It doesn't matter how I got here, how much I drank, or how many drugs we took. We're always here for one another. Tonight, if I needed a friend, I don't know. I don't even know your names. I know very few people's names in here. First of all, I have to try to remember my own and Victor's name. I kind of got that back. My grandkids come in, and I just start rattling off names, and when one of them's face lights up like they heard the name they recognized, I know I got the name right. It's really kind of comical. By the way, last Saturday, we had five kids, a bunch of adults. These are our family. Adults, two extra dogs, and all of us are just dog tired. Kids running everywhere, and I asked Victor to please go out the back door and throw some scraps over the fence. And so he took this bowl of scraps and went out the back door. And our dining room, he came running in the back door, and he said, and he stunk, God Almighty, he stunk. He said, I can't go out there, there's a skunk out there. I can't throw this away, there's a skunk out there. We said, yeah, we know. It got you. He said, no, it didn't get me, but it's out there. I can't go out there. And it got the dog. And I said, Victor, it got you. Go get in the shower. And he said, oh, God, it did. It got it, guys. It really walked on the rug. You could smell it. It was just hilarious. And all the dogs, this dog's from the city that don't know a skunk from a cat, you know, ran right up in that skunk's face, and you know what happened to him. And our city kids are going, oh, my God, what is that? That's Lake Whitney perfume. That's what that is. This is every day at Lake Whitney. Oh, gosh. Well, my sobriety date is August the 7th, 1986. I've been sober 22 years. Nobody would ever believe that I could drink as long as I drank, get to the place I got, sober up the way I sobered up, and be invited to speak among a group of friends. Because everywhere I went, people were hurt and angry with me. I was hurt and angry. And I was talking about how your group started, and I'm reading a book. We're not supposed to reference outside materials, but this has to do with the program. I'm reading a book, And the authors of the book ask this question. Who, what person, had the most impact, spiritual and religious impact, in the last century? And the people they asked this question, they decided they were going to ask the question, get the answers, and look at the list of whoever voted, and determine who was the most influential spiritual person in the last 100 years. They asked the Pope and Middle Eastern philosophers, Billy Graham, people whose names I don't even recognize. And they got the count back in, and guess whose name was at the top of the list? Close. Dr. Bob.
Wow.
Dr. Bob. And these are from the great minds all over the world agreed that Dr. Bob Smith was the most influential spiritual person in the last 100 years. This was a guy that took his last drink, suffered his last drunk, and his first moments of sobriety was Bill Wilson. He grew up in Vermont. He studied the Oxford Group. And he concluded that the essence of the Oxford Group was love and service. Dr. Bob Smith. They called him the ultimate, or the prince of the prince of 12 steps. That's what they called him, the prince of the 12 steppers. And here we are in Meridian, Texas, close to 100 years later. That was in the 1930s. Here we are, and his message going all over the world. And we would agree, we would know. The only person I would have thought might have been better just might have been Bill W. But who was the one who was the quiet one that said, we don't get into radio, we don't get into advertising, we don't sell this product, we give it, we love, we serve people. It was Dr. Bob. And evidently, after reading some about him, he must have had a very quiet, comforting presence about him. That's the kind of person I'm drawn to in recovery, really. And I can imagine a coffee pot and a drunk and somebody like that to talk to. Well, after reading about the way he conducted his life and the impact that he had on recovery, I wanted to ask you a question about this group. When you came here, did you think anybody in this room was great? Did you think you'd ever be thought of as anybody besides a drunk, anything besides a drunk? I didn't think about any of that. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't look anybody in the eye. I didn't think about who was great and who had a message. And I want to read you, tell you guys how great this man was. I want to read you Dr. Bob's last message. It's pretty profound. My good friends in AA and of AA, I feel I would be very remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to welcome you here to Cleveland, not only to this meeting, but those that have already transpired. I hope very much that the presence of so many people and the words that you have heard will prove an inspiration to you, not only to you, but may you be able to impart that inspiration to the boys and girls back home who were not fortunate enough to be able to come. In other words, we hope that your visit here has been both enjoyable and profitable. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago. This is Dr. Bob speaking. I get a big thrill out of looking over a vast sea of faces like this with a feeling that possibly some small thing I did a number of years ago played an infinitely small part in making this meeting possible. I also get quite a thrill when I think that we all had the same problem. We all did the same things. We all get the same results in proportion to our zeal and enthusiasm and stick-to-itiveness. If you will pardon the injection of a personal note at this time, let me say that I have been in bed 5 of the last 7 months, and my strength hasn't returned as I would like. So my remarks, of necessity, will be very brief. But there are 2 or 3 things that flashed into my mind on which it would be fitting to lay a little emphasis. One is the simplicity of the program. Let's not louse it up with Freudian complexes and things that are interesting to the scientific mind, but have very little to do with our actual AA work. Our 12 steps, when simmered down to the last, resolve themselves into the words love and service. We understand what love is. We understand what service is. So let's bear those 2 things in mind. Let us also remember to guard that erring member, our tongue. And if we must use it, let's use it with kindness and consideration and tolerance. And one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken time to explain things to us, to give us a little pat on the back, to take us to a meeting or two, to have done numerous kind and little thoughtful acts in our behalf. So let us never get the degree of smug complacency that we're not willing to extend or attempt to extend that help which has been so beneficial to us, to our less fortunate brothers. Thank you very much. Isn't that profound? He hoped that some little thing he did would have some impact, and that we would be careful what we said, because what we say has power. That we would create and love and be tolerant of one another, love and service. That was his point. And he said that's what the Oxford Group stood for. Evidently, he had translated what Oxford means, the Oxford Group meant, and it meant love and service. And he also said when we walk into a meeting that we look into one another's eyes and we know we'll be there. We tell each other, I will be there for you. Well, I don't know about you, but we've watched a lot of the stock market reports lately, and everybody telling us that the world's going to, we have a little child back there, don't we? World's in bad shape, they say. You and I know better. You and I know better. If having money or having power or having prestige or having anything, if we could run and get it, we would have already done it. If it had worked, it would have already worked. It didn't. And so what they tell me on the news and what I hear other people say, you and I come to a meeting to tell one another it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. If we're worried about our kids, if we're worried about our jobs, if we're worried about our marriage, if we're worried about our house, if we're worried about our car, if we're worried about whatever, we're going to come to a meeting and somebody here is going to tell us it's going to be okay. When Dr. Bob alluded to in another talk he gave, that when we bring our defects to the program, we resolve those defects, we begin to get control over them. But the very same defects that we bring to the program begin to interrupt us in the program. They're the things that cause us to find fault with one another in the room. They're the defects that cause our marriage to feel like it isn't a marriage. They're the things that cause us to have problems on our jobs and to believe what other people say about us when we know it isn't true, or to not believe what we know is the truth. So when we get a resentment or have a problem and our defect comes up like ours has come up in our own home, the only place I know to come to is to you. The only thing I know to read that really works is the big book. Now, I've studied, I've got a group of friends, and we study books from all over the world. One week we may be studying an Eastern philosophy, and the next week we may be studying art by penguins. But, you know, it's called My Two Friends That Are Five People in One. You know, it's just, we just do a little bit of everything. But the solid fact is, if I don't come to AA, I don't have a friend. I'm not capable of being one. I won't have a marriage. I can't do it. It doesn't work. When Dr. Bob talked about unity, what he meant was being there for one another, and that it is the cornerstone. If you look at our triangle, what does it say to us? What are the three things that our triangle says?
Service, unity, and recovery.
There we are. And the principle of unity to him meant that we are there for one another. He talked about it again and again. Victor and I have been married since 1987. I sobered up the first time in early 1982. He says he remembers when I came into a meeting. I don't remember him at all. I was in a fog. My children remember what I looked like. I had long, bushy black hair. I wore feather earrings. I don't know. I was a different woman. That I know. Victor was mad, and I was scared to death. Now, that was in 1982. I drank again in 1986, went into a treatment center to get help for my hope for the last time. I hope I don't ever have to do that again. And then Victor and I married in 1987. Let me tell you about my drinking. When I was in high school, I drank and partied, and I kind of had a good time. When I was in college, I drank and partied, and I kind of had a good time. I suffered a loss in my late teens, early 20s, and the fun stopped. From then on, I drank for a purpose. My idea of drinking was my group therapy. I went out with a group of people that drank just like I did, and we had what we thought was fun, and that was our group therapy. That's the way I grew up. That's what I grew up around. That's what Victor grew up around, was drinking and what have you. My parents were very decent people. They didn't drink. My mother could take a little glass of wine like that and walk around in a group of people all night long and sip on that glass of wine. And it would just infuriate me because I never could do that. I never wanted to do that. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to taste wine. I wanted to drink that stuff. She didn't want the change in color. That's all I ever wanted from it. I never found a drink mixed drink I had was Tom Collins. That's the first and last one I remember liking the taste of. From then on out, it was purposeful drinking and group therapy. That's what it was. Well, when Victor and I got married in 1987, I have to say, the first 10 years of our marriage, we brought everything that you taught us into recovery. We were patient, tolerant. We were of service to one another, helpful to our children. We're still very helpful to our children. Let me tell you, we have four. We have two of them self-supporting through their own contributions and two of them that are still drinking. We don't know what they're doing. But out of the four, we have two that are kind of on their feet. We've been through treatment centers with them. We've been through, Lord Almighty, what have we not been through with those kids? Grandkids that we know a little bit about and grandkids that we don't hardly know at all. But when we were dating, this is what they told us. If you're gonna date a person in recovery, you better get to know what they're like in their disease. You better understand and be able to cope with their defects of character. Now, mine, I'm a silencer. Victor's loud. So we know that in our marriage, I'm going to clam up and I'm going to make you pay. I do it today. I'd like to tell you, I don't do that. I do that. He storms around and raises the roof and makes me pay. It doesn't do us any good, guys. It's a bad number. If I ask you about your marriages, you might be able to tell me what your defects are, and you might not be able to. But if we come in here, we can tell the truth. And I'm here to tell you the truth. First 10 years we were married, we were really nice to one another. And coped with everything pretty darn well. We achieved things professionally that neither one of us thought was ever even remotely possible. Owned companies, bought and sold companies. He's traveled all over the world. I have a picture of him on a horse in Egypt. He's the one with the bald head. The horse is the one with the long tail. He rose to a height in his profession that he was escorted by military personnel all over the world. He was raised in the streets of Phoenix. I was raised in the back seat of a car, moving from state to state. I wound up buying and selling companies. I did okay. I was doing okay when we got married. But something happened to us after we moved to Lake Whitney, and I don't know what it was. He doesn't know what it was. But by the early 2000s, sometime 2000, 2002, 2003, I'm not sure. But here's what happens with the defects of character. What starts out as a 10-minute reflection and going down into the defect becomes an afternoon of the defect. What starts out as 1 inch of distance becomes a month of distance. What starts out as, I'll tolerate you, but I won't be nice to you, became a relationship of silence. That isn't what an AA marriage should be. It isn't what any recovering couple should be. And we began to see that. But Dr. Bob, when I was reading about him today and yesterday, what he said is sometimes we're unified and we don't know we're unified. We've been challenged and we've been tested, and we don't know until we've passed the test that we've really been together. And we've passed the test. In 2005, Victor had to go through 6.5 months of chemotherapy. And I want you to know, he wanted to die. And there were days when I really thought it might have been better if he had. He was incredibly sick and incredibly depressed. And there are people in this room that I went to talk to. They're here. During that time. And now, I told you what his defect is. Storminess. Mine is silence. So in that 6.5 months, I went into a hole like you can't believe. I was depressed and isolated. In September of that year, our son-in-law died. Our world went to pieces in a handbasket. By then, our friends were coming around and saying, you're not going to enough meetings. You can't stay sober if you keep doing this. You can't be a father to those children. And your marriage is going to fall apart. That's what they were telling me. We began to go back to meetings. And the love and service of Alcoholics Anonymous saved our marriage. Period. Now, what we learned is that love and service is something you take home. It isn't something you go to a meeting and hear about, and you're nice to every person in Alcoholics Anonymous, and a shithead at home. It doesn't work that way. And that unity is a state of consciousness. It's not something you read about and hear about. It's something you live out with the people you love. So what we've done since 2005 is we've tried to be nicer to one another. Some days it works, some days it doesn't, but most of the time it's a lot better. We go to basketball games and choir concerts, pick up sick kids at school, bury little dogs that have just been run over, which is what we did yesterday for little kids. And what we have had happen in our home is nothing short of an incredible miracle. It took a death for us to see that if we're not of service in our home, we're of service nowhere. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, the guy that met me at the back of the room was a guy named Bob Schuyler. He was a retired AT&T guy. And I crawled in that back door of that meeting in the Mid-Cities group. And he met me. He said, "Little lady, can I help you?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know if I'm an alcoholic. But something's wrong with me." And he told me that day, there's absolutely nothing that will ever happen in your life or that is wrong with you that Alcoholics Anonymous can't help. And from that day to this day, that has been the absolute God-given truth. Nothing. And I love you.